My name's Tom Brady, Jr. I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't had a drink since July 20th, 1965. Imagine my surprise yesterday when I got off the airplane. I was looking around, and I turned around, and this big white man walked up to me and says, "Hi, I'm Buckwheat." He has changed his hairstyle and his color and everything. But if y'all came here today to hear anything deep and profound, you better go somewhere else. I have a great deal of brain damage. I have two neurons left. And every once in a while they bump together and I have a brain fart, and that's the extent of my deep thinking. I'm here for two reasons. First reason's alcohol. Alcohol beat me, as the big book says, into a state of reasonableness. And I almost died before I got there. And the grace of God. God reached down when I became reasonable and picked me up, stood me on my feet, Charlie. Gave me a brand new life in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm very, very grateful for that. You know, we were talking yesterday, Buckwheat and Charlie and Joyce and I, sitting at a lunch table eating sandwiches and seeing who could tell the tallest story like drunks do. And got thinking about the traditions of this program, got talking about the traditions of this program. This program's precious to me. It's my lifeblood. I want it to be around for a long, long time. And the 12 traditions were fashioned to protect and preserve the integrity of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the 90s, it's very important for us, I think, to pay some attention to those traditions and what they say. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is under tremendous pressure from all kinds of outside agencies to change itself to fit their needs. And they're sending people to us that don't belong here. And they're sending them with their heads full of ideas which are trash. An addict is an addict, a drug is a drug, Alcoholics Anonymous is just another form of group therapy, or it's aftercare for your program. Now, a drug may be a drug, but there's a hell of a difference between the effect of cocaine and the effect of alcohol. And as an addict is an addict. That's true at a certain level. That's what makes it dangerous. But there's a difference between a cocaine addict and an alcoholic also. And Alcoholics Anonymous never has been and is not now, and I hope never will be, just another form of group therapy. And it doesn't serve as aftercare for anybody's program. Alcoholics Anonymous is what was read this morning, a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from what? Alcoholism.
Alcoholism.
Now, let me be clear on this. I don't want to be a ultra-conservative, but I am an AA as far as that's concerned. If you're an alcoholic and you have 10 other addictions, welcome here as an alcoholic. But if you have 10 other addictions, you're not an alcoholic, you don't belong here. Now, does that mean the AA police are going to run you away with a stick? Some of them might, but I'd take you by the hand, and I'd lead you to a place where your needs could be met. And I think it's very important for us to take cognizance of this and study these traditions and understand what it's all about. It's not a sign of arrogance that AA is for alcoholics. It's a sign of humility. The old-timers said, "We know how to fix drunks. Let's don't be so arrogant that we think we can fix everybody." Is that right, Joe? And it's a mark of humility. You know, God bless my brother and sister addicts. I'll do anything in the world I can to help them. But there's reams of information that say that Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics. Now, I don't know if any of y'all know any victims. You know any victims? Victimhood's a growth industry in this country. And I know there are victims out there, and I feel for them. My heart goes out to them, but I know they're going to remain victims until they forgive the ones who victimize them. And I believe when every other person you meet happens to be a victim of this or that or the other, something's out of hand. You know? And I figure sooner or later somebody would come along and pose that we're victims too. And sure enough, from the land of psychobabble in North Carolina, this fellow says, "Alcoholics are the victims of narcissistic wounding And what we need is self-esteem. Well, I don't know if anybody wounded my narcissus. It would piss me off if they did. I know that. But I didn't come here to get self-esteem. I came here to survive. And I was told that if I was going to survive, I had to give up this business of being a victim and accept responsibility for my life and accountability for my behavior. And I believe that. That was hard, but I believe that. AA tells me I'm a victim of one thing, my own delusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this life if I only manage well. That's all. Now, one of my favorite bands is a group called the Eagles. Anybody know the Eagles? They got a new album out called Hell Freezes Over. The lead song in that album is something I like a lot. So I look on the tube, and what do I see? A whole lot of people crying, "Don't blame me." They wave their crooked little fingers at everybody else, spend all the time feeling sorry for themselves. Victim of this, victim of that. Your mama's too thin, your daddy's too fat. Get over it. It's like going to confession every time I hear you speak. You're making the most of your losing streak. Some call it sick, but I call it weak. You drag it around like a ball and chain. You wallow in the guilt. You wallow in the pain. You wave it like a flag. You wear it like a crown. Got your mind in the gutter, bringing everybody down. Bitch about the present and blame it on the past. I'd like to find your inner child and kick its little ass. Get over it. That's very harsh, isn't it? I'm an alcoholic. What do I mean by that? I mean I'm the kind of person who's always believed that anything that feels good should be done to excess. If it feels good, overdo it. So I've had problems with food. I've had problems with gambling. I've had problems, of course, with alcohol. Had problems with sex. I remember when I found out sex felt good. Y'all remember that? I was by myself, just like all of y'all were. And in spite of some dire warnings from my mother about a certain part of my anatomy was going to rot off, or I was going to go blind, I figured it felt so good I'd keep on till I was nearsighted. That was one of my first successes in life. I am nearsighted. And then when I found out it felt good with somebody else, all hell broke loose. I'm the kind of person who likes to do everything at once and do it all perfectly. I know none of y'all are like that. I wake up in the morning with the I gottas. Y'all ever have the I gottas? Think about all the things I'm supposed to do. My body's not even awake and my mind's going 500 miles an hour like a ping pong ball bouncing off the walls, you know. Do everything at once and do it perfectly. You ever try to pee and comb your hair at the same time? Now, women may be able to do that. I don't know, but when you're 6'3", you're going to make a mess one way or the other. I've always been a great starter and a poor finisher. I had two basic speeds, fast forward and stop. Everything I ever did in my life, it was fast forward. You know, let's get in there and get it done, get it over with, and move on to whatever's next. And that was a heck of a thing when I was trying to recover, because when I was hurting, when the pain was on me that Clancy talked about last night, it was fast forward. And then things would get better. And I'd put it on stop and go right back and do the thing that had put me in pain in the first place. Doesn't seem like a big problem, does it? This is a program of follow-through. The 12th step doesn't say we did these steps and that was the end of it. It says we practice these principles in all our affairs. You do it, 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 and you keep on doing it. Until it becomes second nature to you. And when it becomes second nature to you, that means your character has been changed. I've always seen things in terms of either it's this or it's that. There's no in between. In my life, if I wasn't the best at something, in my own mind, I was automatically the worst. Everything was either black or white, and all of life is in the middle. You know? As long as I was striving for perfection as a person, I was doomed to failure. And one of the greatest things in the world today is to be able to accept myself as a combination of things which is good and things which are not good. Somebody said to me not long ago, some people say you're a saint and some say you're a son of a bitch. Which one are you? And I said, I'm both of them. And I always have a hard time accepting that dark part of myself, you know? And I'm a human being. And it's okay to be one of those. And you know it's all right to be a dipshit when you can accept the fact that you're a dipshit? It becomes almost tolerable. Self-acceptance is a part, I believe, of being rigorously honest in this program. It's like being like Popeye. I am what I am, and that's all that I am. Nothing more. Or like Geraldine, the philosopher, used to say, what you see is what you get. That's honesty, as I understand it. My whole life, I believed in magic. I like things to happen to me, and I want them instantly. Never mind the process, Charlie. Give me the results. I'm one of those who came to AA, and yes, I wanted 10 years of sobriety in 10 minutes. And I'm not the only one that's like that. Most of us are in a big hurry. And it doesn't come that way. It's the process that's important. I'm responsible for the process. God's responsible for the result. And my entire life, I was always searching for something to fill up this empty place that I felt in myself from my earliest years. This feeling of something's missing. I don't know what it is. I don't know where I'm going to find it. I don't even know how to look for it. But if I ever find it, everything's going to be okay. That missing piece, that was always there. Now, when I say I'm an alcoholic, I mean I'm a person who lives in a body that will not handle alcohol. It never would. Okay? When I put alcohol into my body sent me a clear and certain message. Get some more of that stuff and get it right now. Now, our friends over in La La Land say that that's because we have a biochemical genetic disorder having to do with the hypothalamic information control center in our brains, that when we ingest ethyl hydroxide, it's converted to acetaldehyde, which combines with dopamine, which becomes tetrahydroisoquinoline, and we lose control. AA says I'm allergic to alcohol. And I mean something was wrong with my mind when I say I'm an alcoholic. Again, those people over there will say, well, he's narcissistic, egocentric, dominated by feelings of omnipotence, intent at all costs on maintaining his own inner integrity. And Alcoholics Anonymous says I'm strangely insane. And here's where Alcoholics Anonymous departs from all the rest. From all the rest. And this, I believe, is the reason for its success. The big book says we've not only been mentally and physically sick, we've been spiritually sick too. And then it says an outstanding thing. Once the spiritual malady is overcome, then we straighten out mentally and physically. Big thing. What's a spiritual malady? You know, I'm a perfectionist and an idealist and a hypersensitive romantic dreamer. And I've never been satisfied with life like it was. I always wanted more. And in order to get more, and I was afraid I wouldn't get it, I got into control. I manipulated you. I used you. I lied to you. I conned to you. You know, I schemed. I did anything to get my way. Pages 60 to 62 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous describe me to a T. And when I tried to do this, you all tried to do it in return, and a wall came up between me and my brothers and sisters, and therefore between me and my God. And I became isolated and separated and lonely. Y'all know what I'm talking about, that kind of lonely and disconnected. And I'm spiritually sick because when I am disconnected from my brothers and my sisters and my God, I am indeed powerless. And why? Because of someone else? No. Because of my own self will run riot, based on fear and the need to control. And the AA solution is simple. Too simple, say some people. It says, first of all, quit playing God. Next, it says, these are the words. We decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God's going to be the director. And you turn things over to God. Then you take a look at that wall and you identify the stones that separate you. And then you ask God to remove those stones, and you step through that wall, and you make amends. You try to repair damage done in the past to your brothers and sisters, and you reconnect with them, and there becomes a we. God, that's an important word in this program. We, first word in the foreword of the first edition of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We, first word in the first step. We, first word in the first tradition, our version of we. We is the basic word of the Spirit. And when I reconnect with my brothers and my sisters, I reconnect with my God, and I'm restored to sanity, and I don't drink, and my body doesn't send me that message. Isn't that a beautiful thing? Too simple, say some. Intellectuals don't understand that. That book that Clancy talked about last night, it's a timeless book. Yes, it's divinely inspired. I'm another one who believes that, because Bill didn't have enough sense to write that. If he was like I was at 3 years sobriety, he's still rum-dum. And you know, that book was reviewed by an intellectual for the Journal of the American Medical Association. And he found, and I quote, absolutely nothing of redeeming value in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, end quote. Well, folks, it just sold its 15 millionth copy not long ago. It's translated in 30 languages, sign language, braille, tape. It's read by more people on a daily basis in this world than any other book on the face of this earth, aside from some religious things like the Bible. And I submit to you, that has done a lot of more good for alcoholics than the members of the American Medical Association. Too simple. Can explain to an intellectual my recovery. Can you imagine my doing that? So you've been sober a long time. It must be awfully strong. I said, no, sir. I admitted my weakness and I got well. And he said, that doesn't make any sense. And intellectually, it doesn't, you know. And he says, well, you must have fought awfully hard to win the victory over alcohol. I said, no, sir, I surrendered. He said, that makes no sense. And I said, I know it doesn't. Well, what do you do? Well, I go to meetings. Oh, group therapy. No, sir, not group therapy. Just a bunch of drunks sit around and talk to one another. We lie to each other a lot. And he said, that makes no sense. And I said, I know it doesn't. And he said, well, what else do you do? Well, I have a sponsor. Oh, a psychotherapist. No, sir, he's a plumber. And he says, that makes no sense. And I said, I know it doesn't. What else do you do? Well, we have this 12-step program. Oh, the great metaphysicians got together with the psychologists, and they laid you out a way to live. And I said, no, sir, it was put together by a bunch of drunks. And he says, that makes no sense. And I say, I know it doesn't. And he said, well, who founded this outfit? And I said, a bankrupt stockbroker and a proctologist who had lost his ass. And he says, that makes no sense. And I said, I know it doesn't. I'm one of those who thinks it's very appropriate that one of our co-founders was a proctologist, by the way. He was dealing with people like us before he ever got here, you know. And I don't think that's strange. But see, AA is a spiritual program. It is not based on thought. It is not based on feeling. It is not based even on prayer. It is based on action. It says to me, no matter what you think or how you feel, there's certain things you've got to do if you're going to change your life and stay sober. Every spiritual program I know of is based on action. You do it, and you do it, and you do it. One spiritual teacher said, which of you by taking thought can add one cubit to your stature? Now, I was one of those who believed in prayer, still believe in prayer, but I believe in prayer which is followed by action on my part. If I pray for something, I better follow that prayer and start doing something. You know? It's like the rabbi and the priest, and they went to a prize fight one night, you know, and before the fight, one of the fighters got down in the corner and prayed evidently and did this, you know, And the rabbi turned to the priest and he said, that's one of your boys, ain't it? He said, yeah. He said, tell me, what does this mean? The priest said, not a damn thing if he can't fight. action.
Let it all hang out.
Action causes me to come back into a proper relationship with my brothers and sisters and my God. And when I'm connected with God, I have the power that disconnected I never had. It's a whole room full of people here today. None of us have got the power to stay sober 1 second. But all of us together somehow have enough power for ourselves and many others outside this room. That's incredible. That's a paradoxical kind of a thing. That's an unbelievable kind of thing. That doesn't fit into the intellectual mind. These strange statements like you have to give it away to keep it. You know? You have to surrender to win. They don't register in the intellectual mind. They don't even register in mine. And this program's full of such paradoxes. And that's part of the reason that it works. And it's not one of those things that I understand and then do it. It's one of those things that I do, and then I might understand it. Like Clancy was talking about last night. Okay? As far back in my life as I can remember, I was afraid. I didn't know what I was afraid of. I was just overwhelmed by fear most all the time, even as a little boy. I'm one of those who believes that fear is just one big ball. You know, it's an evil and corroding thread, as the big book calls it, that shoots through the fabric of my existence. Why? I don't know. Where it came from? I don't know. I do know it was there. And I had a lot to be afraid about. I was the ugliest baby you ever saw in your life. People say, how you know that? I said, my mama told me that. My own mama told me she'd never seen an ugly baby till I was born. And she wouldn't take me out of the house the first 6 weeks I was on the face of the earth. She didn't want anybody to see me. Now, I told the psychiatrist that one time. That's the kind of fodder they chew on, you know. And he said, oh, that must have been traumatic for you. I said, no, sir, I've seen my baby pictures. Mama's right. I was ugly. And as I grew up, things didn't get much better. I was one of those skinny little old boys, you know. Skinny. I turned sideways, looked like a tricycle with handlebars sticking out back here. And I'd try to compensate by bringing my shoulders around and my chest would disappear. It was a no-win situation. And Mother made me wear knickers. Any of you guys have to wear knickers? My leg was that big and the knicker hole was that big and it was always falling down. I hated those knickers. And if that wasn't enough, being skinny, I love freckles on other people, but I had freckles all over me. I had freckles from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. I had freckles where people had never reported having freckles before. And I had them there, and I hated them, you know. And I always wanted to be a macho man, big and strong and tough, you know. My mother had four big brothers, and they were all macho. The most macho one was my Uncle Durwood, who they called Dud. And Dud was a motorcycle cop back in the days when they wore riding breeches, Joe, and leather spats up to their knees, and he had a harness across here with silver bullets stacked in it. Pearl handle 38 sitting high on his hip, you know. He smelled like gunpowder and shaving lotion, and he squeaked when he walked. Now, that's macho. And I wanted to be like that. In addition to the freckles and the skinniness, I had this great shock of snow white hair on top of my head, and all of my macho uncles called me Puddinhead. Now, it's hard to be macho when people call you Puddinhead. I have checked the list of macho names, and Puddinhead ain't one of them. But I'll tell you something. I remember this, and I remember this well. When I was sitting behind my Uncle Dud on that police motorcycle with my arms wrapped around him, I was not afraid. Even then, in retrospect, I needed a higher power. Even then. And my Uncle Dud's one of my heroes. He's 87 years old now. He's still the most macho man in the world as far as I'm concerned, you know. And boy, can he lie. Oh, Lord. Every time he tells me one of his cop stories, the man gets taller and bigger, you know. And he chased him further, you know. My aunt will sit there and listen to him and just shake her head, you know. I love him to death. He's my hero. I think we need heroes in this program. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not talking about idols. I'm not talking about these pure guys and poor guys and gals we take and sit up on a pedestal and demand perfection of them. And the first time they screw up, we rip them apart. I'm talking about heroes. Heroes are the people who get out there in the beet fields and do it. And they make big mistakes and they get up and clean themselves off and go some more. And they succeed a little bit and they thank God and they go some more and they fall again. The ones that get up and keep doing it. Those are the heroes in this program. And I need them, and I wouldn't be sober today without my heroes in this program. I can name them for you today. Most of them are dead, but they're not. As long as I'm standing on 2 feet, every one of them lives. Pass it on, said Bill. Then passed on to me by some good ones. Good ones. I used to look back on my childhood, and all I could see was what Mama didn't do and what Daddy did do and what all these other things, you know, and it was a pretty black and dark picture. And I got to looking back in retrospect, you know, and I began to see some good things about my childhood. You know, it wasn't all dark like I thought. It was a funny thing. Once I could look back and see one good thing, I could see two. Then I could see three. Then I could see four. And finally, it took on some balance, you know. I was always looking for a storybook childhood, like the Bobbsey twins, you know. Storybook childhoods are in storybooks. And mine wasn't that bad. I was born in a little textile mill town down in North Carolina. And the railroad track went right down the middle of it. And on one side of the tracks, all the workers lived in houses that were just alike. You know, on the other side, two- and three-story houses. That's where the management lived and the doctors and the lawyers. Y'all know towns like that. And everybody on that side of the street was like family to me. We didn't have the same names, you know. But I ate at your house and I played at your house. If I misbehaved, I got punished at your house. Not abused, punished. And in the mill village, here was the routine. Boy, you do that, I'll whip your ass. And you did that, and that's exactly what they did. And that's when I first started hearing this mama talk. Y'all know what mama talk is? What your mama says to you don't make a bit of sense? Mama would be whipping me, you know, for doing something. And she'd say, son, remember, this hurts me worse than it does you. I never did understand that. I always wanted to say, Mama, give me that stick. I don't want you hurting like that. And I love those people on that block, you know, and I remember them as if they were here today. The lady next door was named Lena. She's the best cook on the block, the best eater on the block, too. Lena was heavy. I used to love to hug Lena. Man, when you hug Lena, you had a breast in each ear, you know. And she'd rub me on the head and say, I love you, Puddin', and I'd go, And it wasn't anything sexual about it, see? It was like being surrounded by warm, fleshy love. She's here today, I'd hug her today, you know. And she had a son named Bill Jr. He's one of my friends. He's one of those little boys programmed for self-destruction. He was always cut or skinned or bruised, you know. If he was within 10 yards of your car, you didn't shut the door, his hand would be in it. I never knew a boy. And he had the most beautiful curly black hair, and he hated it, and he wanted to be straight like mine. And we found some lard one day, buckwheat, and fixed his hair. And then the curls started popping back up. I don't know what. Old Bill hated to bathe. Lena had him in the tub. She turned her back. He'd escape. She'd come out on the front porch and say, Puddin', he's loose again. There goes Bill's naked ass up the street in Irwin, North Carolina, you know. And I'd chase him down to Clay Hill, which is a big pile of dirt that the railroad brought in to do something with, but they never did. And when it would rain, Clay Hill would get slick. We'd get box tops and go down and slide down Clay Hill. Y'all remember doing things like that? Get the nicest feeling when you do that. And I'd take him home and hold him while his mama bathed him. We lived in the next house. My daddy was the sweetest man I ever knew in my life. The kindest, gentlest, best human being I have ever run into. He's my number one hero. He's the one I want to be like. Sixth grade education. Couldn't even speak good English. Seldom said he loved you, but it exuded from him. You know that kind of people? It came out of him. He'd come to visit me when I had kids, you know, and the word would spread through the neighborhood like wildfire. In 15 minutes, every kid in the neighborhood would be there. My daddy go walking down the street, followed by kids and dogs. Now, man, when kids and dogs take to you, you got something going for you. I believe that with all my heart. My mother was a black belt Southern Baptist. Y'all know what I mean by that? She got up 4:30 every morning to give God his directions for the day. She called it praying, but I knew better than that. And then she'd read 10 chapters in the Bible because Billy Graham said, do it, you know. There was one answer to everything. One answer to everything. And my mother tried to relive her life through me. She demanded that I be perfect at everything I did. And even when I was perfect, there was the unspoken message from her, you can do better than this. You know? Mom was one of those people who didn't know how to love. She didn't know how to hug you or kiss you or anything like that. The only way she knew was to give you money. She almost killed me, bailing me out of jail when I started drinking. You know? And I used to get off on my mama. Lord, psychiatrists helped me with that. And one of them told me, if I had a mama like yours, I'd drink more liquor than you. You know? And that was all mama's fault for a long time. And yes, I hated her. But I'm going to tell you something. Mama's dead now. She's up there giving God direct directions now. If I called her today from Marietta, Georgia, and said, Mama, I want you to come down here and die for me. You know what? she'd be right there. You understand? Isn't it time we cut our parents slack? You know? Mother didn't know how to love overtly. She loved me in the only way she knew how to love. Next house lived John Q. His father was named Q, and he ran the theater downtown, you know, and he was a nice man, a handsome man. I remember every Christmas Eve, he'd have us all in the front yard and put on a big fireworks show for all the kids in the town, you know, and while everybody else got Santa Claus ready, he'd have us out in the front yard. Remember old man Lucas come by the house in his old wooden wheelbarrow, going down to slop the hog, Charlie. And he'd call me, and I'd jump in that wheelbarrow, and he'd drive me down to hog pen. And while he slopped the hogs, I'd go over and wade in the creek and drink some cool water out of it. You could do it in those days. Catch me a few crawdads, you know. Now I'd walk home and take my shoes off, and I'd feel that sand in between my toes. And if you asked me where I was going, I'd say nowhere. Where are you coming from? Doesn't make any difference. What you doing? Nothing. See, I was an expert at just being when I was a kid. I don't know when I started being and started pretending, but it wasn't long. Okay. I remember I used to go to movies every Saturday. It cost 9 cents to go to a movie. That's how old I am, y'all. And Mr. Beard ran the theater. And popcorn was a nickel a box, fresh popped. And if you ran out of popcorn, he knew you didn't have any money. Stick your box out there. He'd fill it up again. And for 14 cents, I'd spend the whole day at the movies, you know, and I'd see Westerns, double feature Westerns for 9 cents, with a couple of good serials like Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon, you know, and some good cartoons, not this monster crap you see on TV. Now I'm talking about Bugs Bunny and Porky Pig and Wile E. Coyote, who's one of my role models to this day. And I love those cowboys. Now, you young folks have to watch TBS some Sunday morning about 4 o'clock, and you might see some of these guys, you know? There was Rocky Lane and the Durango Kid and Hopalong Cassidy and Sunset Carson and Wild Bill Elliott, who wore 2 silver 6-guns turned backwards. You remember, Joe? You draw down on Wild Bill, he'd spin those guns around, shoot the guns out of your hands, because cowboys was polite then. And my favorite cowboy was a guy named Lash LaRue. Now, Lash carried a bullwhip. You draw down on Lash, he whooped the gun out of your hand. He was the coolest cowboy around, man. I was watching Lash one day stand up on the roof of the saloon. He'd run all the bad guys out of town. He popped his whip and whistled, and his horse came running by. He popped that whip again and jumped into the saddle and rode off into the sunset. So help me, tears came to my eyes. That was a moving experience, man. And I sat through it again and again and again. And I went home that day, and you got to emulate your heroes. I got a piece of rope and went up on the garage. And the boy next door had a pony named Beauty. I said, John Q, go saddle up Beauty. And he did. I said, now walk her past the garage. And he did, and I popped my rope and whistled and leapt into the saddle. And when I hit it, you could have heard me scream in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I don't know if that was a spiritual experience, but I never forgot it, I'll tell you that. And 30 minutes later, when I got my breath back, I started wondering about Lash LaRue. I still do. Now, I used to sit up in the chinaberry tree. We called them Cheney ball trees up there. And do my deep thinking. Y'all remember when you did your deep thinking? You'd go off under the chrysanthemum bush or, you know, out behind some bush and just be alone and just watch your thoughts go through your head. And I'd watch my thoughts go through and I'd say, I got a good daddy and a good mom and some good friends. I love Lash LaRue and all those other heroes, you know. But there's this empty place inside of me. And I wonder if it's ever going to get filled, because I know if it does, I'm going to be okay. Now, Mama, being a black belt Southern Baptist, we went to church a lot. Sunday morning for Sunday school, Sunday for church, training union and church on Sunday night, Monday night, Thursday night, Wednesday night. You go to church a lot. And Mama always put on her war clothes to go to church. But I always wore dark colors like black or blue. Made me think God liked dark colors. And she'd put on a corset. Now, I'm not talking about a girdle. I'm talking about a corset. Mama go in her bedroom. I could hear her exhaling all the wind out of her body and pulling up that damn corset with the strings in the back. She had a brassiere with hormones. She'd string that thing on, put on that black dress, come out of that room, couldn't move nothing, but her head looked like a buzzard sitting on a fence, just like this, you know. And I'd be laughing. She'd say, what you laughing at, son? I said, Mama, why do you do that? You're a pretty woman. She'd say, because it's Sunday. There's some more of that mama talk. I was a smart kid. I figured out Sunday means church. Church means God. God does not want my mother to breathe on Sunday. And one particular Sunday, we went to church, and I was sitting there. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, that empty space got full. I never will forget that. I was 9 years old. I could take you to that little Baptist church in Irwin, North Carolina, and show you the spot where it happened right now. It was the most wonderful experience I ever had. And I thought, God, I like this. I hope it never goes away and it's gone just quick as it come. Y'all ever have an experience like that? Went back to that church again and again and again, hoping it happened again, making sure I sat in the same place. Never happened again. When I was 15 years old, I drank some of the awfulest tasting stuff you ever drank in your life. The label on it said cream of Kentucky. And you know what happened? The empty space was full. Okay. I was comfortable, unafraid, equal, worthy. See, I hated my guts. I didn't like me when I was a kid at all. And so to compensate for that, I had to make you like me. I had to make you approve of me because I couldn't. I had to make you accept me because I couldn't. So I excelled at everything I did. You get plenty of attention when you're in the spotlight. I was a disgusting little boy. I excelled at everything. Enough to make you puke looking back on it. And yet, when I excelled and I got the spotlight and everybody was approving and accepting and applauding, I was saying to myself, this ain't it. What's next? Yeah. Got to tell you something. First 5 years I was out here on the circuit in Alcoholics Anonymous. Before the people stood up and applauded, I didn't amount to a damn thing. And after they sat down, Charlie, I didn't amount to a damn thing again. You understand what I'm saying? And this morning, if you stand up, that's fine. And if you don't, that's fine too. Because I'm a good man and I know it. But that took some doing. That was one of my worst defects of character, if not the worst, was my own hate for me. I treated me so bad it'd make you sick. If anybody else had treated me as bad as I treated me, I'd have killed them. When things got good for me, I'd louse them up every single time. Like it says in the big book, I'd use my talents to build up a bright future for myself and my family. Then I'd bring the whole thing down around my head by what? A senseless series of sprees. That's me. Why? Why couldn't I let you tell me you love me without giving you 10 excuses why you shouldn't? Why couldn't I let you tell me I'd done a good job without giving you 3 or 4 reasons why I should have done it better? But I thought I'd found the answer to life. And I remember the boys I was with that night passed out and puked and all that stuff. You know, I didn't. I sent the cab driver back and got me a bottle of cream of Kentucky that very night. And by the time I was 16 or 17 following this elixir of life, I drank for 15 more years. I never had that same experience again. Did you? Never. I'd get that close and go right past it. You know? God, it was frustrating. By 16 and 17, I was a regular visitor at the Wake County Jail in Raleigh, North Carolina. My mother, hostess of the Tabernacle Baptist Church. My father on the board of deacons for 50 years. And their son making the social pages. Drunk and disorderly. Public drunk. Drunk driving. Following the elixir of life. By the time I was 23, I'd had over 1,000 stitches taken in my face alone as a result of drinking. You know? And I was caught up in this obsession. Someday, somehow, if I just handle it right, I'm going to be able to control and enjoy my drinking, and I'm going to have that experience again. God, I love that experience. People say we're running from life. We're trying to escape. I wasn't. I was chasing after that same experience I had in that hotel room when I was 15 years old. And it was just as spiritual as the one I had in the church at 9 years old. Carl Jung pointed out to Bill Wilson that the historical name for alcohol was spirits. And I believe that the way I felt that day was a spiritual experience. I started coming around y'all when I was 23. I don't remember why. I think I must have been in some kind of trouble. I was one of those drunks, you know, when the test pattern would go out on TV and all the liquor was gone, I'd say, shit, I need some help. And I came to y'all, and it was an easy take. I mean, there's a man standing up front with a blue book in front of him, 12 steps on a plaque over here, 12 traditions on a plaque over here. My way of doing things, Leroy, come in there and master it and get up to the top real quick. And I figured the way to do that is memorize those things and memorize what's in that book. And I did. I can quote great portions of the book to you today, but I don't have to anymore, and that's a great freedom. It's a great freedom. But that's all I had. I was going to do it my way. And for the next 7 years, the longest I ever stayed dry was 89 days. It wasn't lack of knowledge. You see, the reason I didn't get sober, I'm going to tell you flat out. Alcoholics Anonymous is a system. And if I fulfill the conditions of the system, in other words, follow the directions of the system, it's going to do for me exactly what it says it'll do. If I don't fulfill the conditions of the system, it will not do it in any way, shape, form, or fashion. And I didn't follow the system. And the system says, be in the community of Alcoholics Anonymous, not just go to meetings. See, I was a visitor at meetings, Charlie. I visited when I was hurting. Then I quit visiting when I felt better. No, it says, get in there and be a member of the community. The we, this is what you need. And I was always like a fly on the wall, you know, watching them practice AA. I didn't know this. And so this is not a self-put-down. And the other condition, big condition, is follow directions. Which directions? The one in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And the ones that your sponsor give you. I never read the book Alcoholics Anonymous except when I was drinking. I got whiskey glass circles all over the front of my big book. Or when I was hurting. And I was too rum-dumb when I was hurting to understand the thing that I read. And I never had a sponsor. And I wonder why, as Chuck used to put it, the turtles of life were passing me by like this riding motorcycles. I knew I was smarter than they were. You know, and I met some mean, ugly, hateful, profane people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They called them old-timers. Dumb people. Talk in circles, man. There's one old boy up in Burlington, North Carolina named Bill Crumpler. God bless him. He's one of my heroes today. I called him Grumpy. I hated his guts. He'd wait for me to get to meetings. He denied it, but I knew he was laying in wait for me because he'd meet me at the door and point his finger at me and say, how you doing, boy? And I'd say, I'm fine. And he'd back me into the corner and go to cussing and tell me how I was. That's scary. You know that? Somebody reads your insides like a book. And you always talk in circles. Boy, he'd say, you can't think your way into good living. You got to live your way into good thinking. And I'd think to myself, you ugly old bastard. Shut up! But I never said anything to him because I was scared of him. You understand? And boy, how come you always run around looking for God? He ain't lost. Oh, I love that one. And Grumpy tried to work with me. He tried his best. God bless his heart. I was just unworkable with. And I called him one morning about 3 o'clock. He did me a great favor. He said, boy, don't ever call me again, drunk. He said, matter of fact, don't you ever call me again. He said, where we meet and don't call me to come get you. You can walk. He said, frankly, I don't give a damn if you ever get sober. I'm a sensitive person. That really hurt my feelings. I said things about him you ought not to say about people. And I bless him today. And you know, he never changed, Joe. Last time I saw Bill Crumpler, he was dying of cancer in a hospital in Wilmington, North Carolina. I had been sober 16 years, and I walked in the door of his room, and he pointed his finger at me and said, boy, you'll never make it. Ain't that something? And I kept on, and I couldn't understand why. And then alcohol did me a favor, big favor. It whooped me good. Yeah. And I came to on the floor in an apartment that I didn't own, and my wife and kid were gone again. You know, my alcoholism had become so bad, when I got the compulsion to drink, I would go out and buy my wife and daughter presents before I'd get drunk. Because I knew I was going to do it, and I knew I couldn't not do it. You understand? But this morning, I knew I couldn't drink. And it wasn't a head trip. It was all down in the gut. And I knew for the first time, I think, that I could not quit. And I knew I was going to die. I knew it. Now, by this time, I'm on 5 years probation, 2-year sentence on a chain gang hanging over my head.
I'm a professor at a community college about to lose my job. I didn't have a driver's license and was never supposed to drive again in the state of North Carolina. And I made a profit out of Grumpy because I walked back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went late and I left early. But people said strange things to me. It's good to see you. We're glad you're here. We need you. And I think to myself, God, if they knew who I was, they wouldn't say that. But they kept on saying it. And they found out I was walking. And I never walked again. First 2 years I was sober, I went to a meeting every night without the first driver's license. Car pulled up in front of my house every night. We called it group sponsorship in the old days. They didn't just hand you their number and say, call me. They got my number. I'd get 6-8 phone calls a day from guys in that group I didn't know from Adam, you know? And one of them would come by the house every night and pick me up for a meeting. Group sponsorship. What's happened to it? Nowadays, we hand them our phone number and say, call me, son. Like we missed a big shot. I'm a drunk, not a big shot. I kept watching this one man in the group, and I liked him. I liked the way he moved. I liked the way he talked. And I'm not going to lie to you. I liked the fact that he drove a Continental and wrote $4,000 suits, too. Didn't bother me a bit. But the man had the best eyes I'd ever seen in my life. His eyes just sparkled, you know, and I couldn't look at him because I was afraid he might see me. It kind of scared me. And I sidled up to him one night, and I said, I don't want to die. Will you be my sponsor? And he turned on me and he pointed his finger at me and he said, boy, I've heard about you. They tell me you're not just an alcoholic. They tell me you're crazy as hell. But he said, I'll help you on one condition. I said, what's that? He said, we'll do it my way. And I don't know but one way, and it's in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You willing to do that, boy? And I said, yes, sir. Yes, sir. See, without knowing it, Leroy, I had surrendered because I began to take directions. You can talk to me about surrender until the cows come home. If you ain't taking the directions of the book and what your sponsor says to you, you are not surrendered. And I said to him, yes, sir, let's do it. You ever notice how your sponsor seems so wise and erudite till you ask him to be your sponsor and then he goes stupid on you immediately? Well, that's what Harry did, you know. Joe knows Harry. Harry said, first thing I want you to do is go to meetings early and shake everybody's hand and ask them how they're doing. I said, I don't want a girl. I don't want to shake their hands. I don't care how they're doing. And why do I have to do that? He said, boy, you don't ask me why. You do what I tell you to do. A lot of people confuse the sponsor with the counselor. And they ain't the same, man. You know, I got a master's degree in counseling. I hope you're impressed by that. I'm not, you know. But if I told you to do something like that, my next question would be, how's it make you feel? My sponsor didn't seem to give a happy shit how it made me feel. You know what I mean? And I came to know that nobody cared more about my feelings than Harry did. But here again, he knew what I had to do no matter how I felt. You understand? And he preached at me. Effort, result, effort, result. You don't understand the spiritual way of life and then do it, son. You do it and then you might understand it. Man, he'd give me stuff to read in the big book, and I finally got up the nerve to tell him, Harry, I can't read one sentence without forgetting it before I get to the second one. And he said, well, just read one sentence, son. He said, you've been demanding more of yourself than you could give your entire life. Why don't you cut yourself some slack? That was a novel idea. So I read my one line, and I'd want to remember things I heard at meetings, and I couldn't remember them, Joe. And he said, take a pencil and paper. Here's a guy that graduated with majors in philosophy and history, a 3.94 average, who's who among students in American universities and colleges, with notes and paper copying what drunks say. And I cried. People look at me, I'd cry. I hadn't cried in years, unless you fell down and hurt yourself, or, you know, I'd laugh at you then so hard I'd cry. They'd ask me to read the preamble. Like I couldn't read it. I'd stand up there and cry. Harry'd come get me. Say, that's all right, son. Sit down. Your day will come. The night I finally read the preamble to the meeting without crying until the end of it, they broke into applause. When I picked up my 3 months chip, you'd have thought I'd been sober 30 years. That place went crazy. Even Grumpy came down to see it. He didn't believe it. In and things started changing. Did I have a great flash like I always thought I wanted? Hit me with a lightning bolt, God. Give me a spiritual experience like Paul, you know? Give me one like Moses. Moses was so big he stuttered the rest of his life. It came in a little bitty realization. One day I was sitting at work, you know, and I realized I hadn't wanted a drink in over 3 months, Joe. And I cried like a baby. God, I cried like a baby. And I knew, I didn't know why, Charlie, but I knew it had something to do with what I was doing. And so I got a little more careful about doing it, you know. And I got into it a little heavier. And I remember going to a little chapel after I'd taken my seventh step, and I sat down, and there was a stained glass window up, and the carpenter was in that window, but there was no cross. And the thought came into my mind, where's his cross? And the thought came back, it's been removed, Tom, and so has yours. You know, little realization. I wasn't seeing things the same. My perception was changing. My behavior was changing. My thinking was changing. Not because I tried to change each of them at one time, but because of the actions I was taking, dictated by my sponsor. And one day he called me. I've been sober about 18 months. He said, a young man over at my house, he's 24 years old. His name's Carl, and you are now his sponsor. He's on the way to your house. And he said, before you can tell me you don't know enough to be a sponsor, just shut up. And he hung up the phone. And God, that boy was the light of my life. And then there was Jerry, and then there was Lyle, and then there was, you know, God. It's given me so many opportunities to work with so many people over such a long time. And sometimes I forget that. And each one of them is a gift. Each one of them is a gift. And I'm supposed to, in this program, fit myself to be a maximum service to God and the people about me. And life has changed. You know that daddy that I love so much? When I was 18 years old, the judge gave me a choice. Either go to jail or go to service. And I got patriotic quickly. And I joined the United States Air Force, and the day that I left, my daddy took me down there, and while he was telling me how much he loved me, he had his hand planted firmly on my butt, pushing me up on that bus. He wanted me out of his life, man. My dad died with lung cancer. We became such good friends over the years, you know. So close, and daddy was a man of few words, you know. I remember one time I was a dangerous drunk, you know, and I'd been reading the Bible. I used to read the Bible when I was drunk, too. That's before I got to the big book. But I'd been reading the story of the prodigal son, and I turned on my daddy. We was having an argument. I said, well, give me what's mine, and I'll get out of here. He said, you're wearing it. Get your ass out the door. I remember one night we went to a meeting, you know, and the guy picked up a chip, and everybody was applauding. On the way home, he said, what are everybody applauding for? I said, I've been sober 4 years. He said, I've been sober 74 years. Ain't nobody applauding me. The morning before he died, he turned over and he looked at me, this daddy that I adored. He said, am I going to die? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, when? I said, the doctor says it'll be very soon. Does that frighten you? And he said, yeah, it does, but I learned a long time ago when you're afraid, you give the fear to God and go about your business. And he gave me the greatest gift on the face of God's earth. I never have to have another but this. He looked at me and he said, son, I love you. You're one of the finest men I've ever known in my life. That's a change. That's a change. You know? My son's in this program now. Charlie picked up a 4-year chip last month. God love him. They called him Puddinhead number 2. He introduced me to talk not long ago, and the boy got up there and said, the speaker tonight's the finest man I know. He's my hero. He's my father. Somebody told me in a meeting not long ago, you know something? See, you're the kindest, gentlest, sweetest man I've ever met. Isn't it strange that when you quit chasing the dreams that you want to be and live in the now, which is the world of the Spirit, that which you dreamed for is given you by the grace of God through a wonderful program designed by a bunch of drunks. Lord, have mercy. It's almost more than I can comprehend. Now, my life the last 5 years hasn't been easy. I used to think if I got sober, what happened to me was going to change. The world was going to change. I was misled about that somehow. Well, it hasn't changed. The last 5 years, I've had 6 or 7 surgeries, one of them for cancer. I had deep venous thrombophlebitis. I've got emphysema. I got high blood pressure. The woman that I adored with all my heart and wanted to be with the rest of my life walked out on me. My mother got Alzheimer's. My sponsor got Alzheimer's. I almost went bankrupt. within a period of 3 months, my mother died, and this woman that I adored killed herself in a head-on collision. Two more dear friends died, and one tried to commit suicide. I was affected. I was affected, like it says in the book. We react sanely and normally. I reacted sanely, Charlie, because I didn't even think about drinking. I reacted normally because I grieved, and I grieved heavily. You understand? But I didn't think about drinking. Do you hear that? Sometimes I think sanity is all there is, man. What this program really does for me that is great and wonderful is it totally removes the obsession to drink. Okay. And I stand here and say, life's good. You know, life's good. Now, a friend of mine from Alabama one time gave me a tape of a guy singing a song. She said, this reminds me of you, and said, I want you to listen to this. And I'm going to do it in close as if it were a dialogue between my two daughters and my son and my mama and myself. Now, keep in mind that mama was a black belt Southern Baptist, and there was only one answer for everything, okay? If I can remember the words, let me close with this. My oldest daughter, Christy, says, Daddy, why aren't you famous? And I said, Christy, I think I am. Because all the people you see here today came out here to give me a hand. But their applause isn't what really matters. It's what I can feel from their hearts. And if today I made dreamers of some who have lost them, I made friends with a few who were scared. Or if it was one new believer who came here, a critic, and I told him that somebody cared. And Christy, I always feel famous, though I'm not seen on TV. I get all the attention my ego can handle doing this live and for free. You see, I do it live and for free. My daughter Frances said, but Daddy, why are you lonely? And I said, Frances, I guess I am. Because there are a few people that I miss today who aren't here to give me a hand. But you know, in there some ways they're closer than the people out on my front row. And if I'm quiet, I can hear Grumpy's heart beating rhythm, see Chuck C. driving his car. And there are preachers and poets that I never met, like Bill W., who hasn't gone far. So I'm alone, but I'm not really lonely. I just got a group you can't see. They give me all the companionship my faith can handle doing this talking with me. You see, they do this talking with me. And my son Jason said, but Daddy, I think you're crazy. I said, Jason, that's what keeps me sane. I was born with a strange sense of humor to go with a strong sense of pain. And I found that there's nothing too serious that it can't hold its own in a joke. So I may smile at stories about people suffering and laugh about losing my hat and make people think I give talks without answers because I tease them and hide where they're at. But I also love things that are simple. And a smile is the last thing you'll see on the face of this crazy old outlaw laughing out loud because I'm me. I laugh like this because I'm free. And then Mama. But Tommy, do you love Jesus? I said, Mother, doesn't it show? She said, I've been listening to you for an hour, and frankly, I've got to say no. Because if you did, you'd be famous. Big concerts and Christian TV. You'd be so well known that you'd never get lonely. You'd never be crazy or weird. But you've got to give up making talks without answers, and you ought to shave off that old beard. Now, so I love you too, Mother. But you sure found it different than me. You see, I do my best, and I do it like Jesus, because he did it live and for free.